I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke. Emma, tell me, what have you been up to?
I am on week one of 2 weeks off work, which is really, really good, but I'm not doing a whole lot. I've been away to stay in a hotel for the first time since lockdown, which was really strange. And it was almost like we forgot how to check in. We're like, hello, we're here for rooms to stay overnight here. Us, we booked online. It's just like, how have we forgotten to book into a hotel? It was very strange.
Communicate with civilization.
I know, but it was also a very strange hotel. It was a little bit backwards, and we went down to ask for more pillows, and they looked at us as if we'd asked them for like an orgy or something.
Oh, it was
the most bizarre thing. Like, oh hi, yeah, we're just checking if you've got any more pillows for the room. And they're all looking at each other, and then the housekeeper goes, well, I'll see what I can rustle up for you. Is this was like a completely alien request? See, that was a little bit odd.
That feels like a basic request. They normally have spare pillows in the wardrobe.
You would have thought so. We did check there, but yeah, it was overall quite a strange stay, but enjoyable nonetheless. And just nice not to be in our own house, which we've been in for months on end. But I did listen to another Scottish true crime podcast, which is called Skinwalker. Have you heard of this?
No.
Yeah, so it's a guy who does it by himself. I know a lot of people like Scottish accents that listen to us, so obviously go and have a wee listen, see what you think.
Is it a single host podcast?
It's a single host podcast, and it's a man with a lovely Scottish voice, and he seems to do a lot of research into the cases, and he's just got quite a nice way of telling the stories.
Good, might check
so
it out.
So far, I would recommend the podcast, definitely. How about you? What have you been up to?
I have been listening to my usual podcasts. I've been getting back into the swing of things, but actually I watched two episodes back to back of that documentary called Dirty Money on Netflix.
Is it good?
Yeah, so I think I've got over the two seasons, I've got about three episodes left. And at the end of it, I felt, do you remember me talking about how the podcast that I love called Swindled's, it kind of ruined your faith in humanity a little bit?
It made you feel a bit disillusioned, didn't it?
Yes. This documentary is a little bit like that, to be honest. So after I watched the second one, I sort of just felt like, you know, when you kind of feel like you've got the weight of the world on your shoulders. I think it was just a bit too much. I feel like with lockdown and everything and life isn't really back to normal yet, I feel that my mental state is slightly fragile and I need to carefully expose myself to, you know, things. Yeah, exactly. So the second one, which is the one that kind of hit home for me a bit, was the VW emissions scandal, the dirty diesel cars. Yeah, that just kind of devastated me a bit, if I'm honest.
That kind of thing is so easy to fall down a rabbit hole as well. And
yeah,
you find yourself Googling things and you're on Reddit, you're reading the conspiracies, you're like, oh my God, every car I've ever driven has probably done this. I'm part of the problem. Like, it's just...
Yeah, and have you seen that one?
No, but I know the background to the story.
Yeah. So in order to counteract it, tonight I watched Wayne's World.
Yes.
And I just thought, you know, I just need something really silly and stupid that I don't really have to pay much attention to, just to kind of like feel a bit lighter.
Yeah, my go-to's for stuff like that, Clueless.
Oh yeah.
And 10 Things I Hate About You. 10 Things I Hate About You was one of my favourite films ever when I was a teenager.
I remember that. I think, am I not right in saying that Clueless is based on
Shakespeare?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
They both are based on different Shakespeare plays.
Ah.
They're just good fun. And I think because I know everything that happens, sometimes there's a bit of relaxation in that, I think. People rereading books, rewatching films that where they already know what happens. You don't need to invest too much emotionally, and you're not going to be let down or horribly scared or upset or, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, there's definitely something comforting about falling back into an old book or an old film. Just before we go on to your case this week, I just wanted to do a couple of little shout outs. I know you wanted to shout out to my mum, which is super cute. So thank you so much to my mum and everybody else that listens. We really do appreciate it. It's amazing when we get people contacting us, especially if we know them, we've not spoken to them in a long time. So Hillary, that I went to school with, thank you so much for your email. I've been a little bit rubbish at looking at the email, so I'm just going to respond to you shortly, but that meant a huge amount to receive that. And yeah, just to everyone that's reached out and everyone that's listened, we really appreciate all the support.
I just wanted to say, I love how your mum is a committed listener. I love how every Friday, you know, she sits down to enjoy the podcast. She's just a devoted listener. She's left us a lovely review, as have so many other people left us lovely reviews and given us ratings. Without that feedback, we don't know if what we're doing is good, bad, or indifferent. There are things that we've changed since the start. You know, so we do listen to what people are saying to us, and we do take the feedback on board. This is content purely for the people that are consuming it. So it's of utmost importance that the people that are actually consuming this podcast are enjoying it as much as they can be. Yeah, your mum's great.
She has comments on every case as well afterwards. She's got little notes that she'll message me, which is amazing.
We've had some lovely reviews and lovely comments, which is great. And, you know, it helps us to keep going and to keep doing what we're doing. So, yes. I'd just like to say thank you to Mammy Laurie.
Oh, she's the best. Bless her. I believe that your case this week was prompted by multiple recommendations, including one from my old school friend, Hillary. So I think, yeah, I'm super excited to get into this.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
As you know, the case that I'm going to cover today is one that is probably one of the cases that I've been most keen to cover since we started. As we know, and as we like to tell people, we are keen to cover less well-known, more obscure cases, cases that need a bit of spotlight thrown on them, a bit of
coverage, really.
A bit of coverage, yeah, for sure. However, occasionally, you know, there's just that big case that I just want to dig right into that I might know some basics about from watching or consuming things over the past little while, and this is one of those cases. As well as you saying that we had a few people requesting this case, I actually asked one of my best friends the other day, I asked her if she had any cases that she would like us to consider covering, and she recommended this case, and I said,
that's always good.
Already on it, we're recording it this week. So the case that I'm covering this week is the case of Alistair Wilson, which is the banker from Nairn, or as some people know it, the doorstep murder. Alistair Wilson. He was 30 years old and he was the younger of two children. And he was from a place called Beath, which is 22 miles southwest of Glasgow. He was a well-regarded pupil at school. He was well thought of. When he finished school, he went on to study at Stirling University. He got an undergraduate degree in accountancy and business law. And he graduated from university in 1996. After graduating from Stirling University in 1996, he joined what was then the Bank of Scotland, which is now known as Halifax Bank of Scotland, or HBOS. He joined their graduate programme the same year that he graduated. During his work at the Bank of Scotland, he was placed in Fort William, which is sort of northwest Scotland. He was placed in Fort William and he actually met his future wife there, Veronica. And they met and they were engaged within 6 weeks of meeting. So instant kind of click. He had moved around a little bit due to different opportunities with the bank. He'd been up in Fort William and then he'd been back down to Edinburgh at the headquarters of the bank. And then he was back up north again. And apparently when he went back up north, he was delighted. You know, he obviously liked it up there. At the time of his death, he actually lived in a place called Nairn. I've never been to Nairn, but it's northeast. I think it's around 20 miles from Inverness. It's in the Highlands of Scotland and it's on the coast. Nairn is apparently, it's a lovely seaside town.
Famous for oatcakes also.
Yes.
Yeah, which is quite an odd one.
But yeah, a sort of a bit of a touristy place, you know, it's on the coast, nice beach, I think.
Picturesque, isn't it?
Yeah, ice cream, fish and chips, probably that kind of thing. The description that I read about Nairn was that it was a nice place.
It's quite affluent, I believe, as
yes,
well.
Yes, but it was saying not stuffy.
Yeah.
So the description that I read basically said, you know, somebody wouldn't bat an eyelid if you walked down the street wearing, like, you know, a full tweed walking gear, or if you were in a tracksuit. You know, nobody would bat an eyelid either. It seems like it's quite a mixed place, but there's probably a bit of wealth there, I think. He was up in Nairn with his wife, Veronica. They had been married for 6 years at this point, and they now had two young boys, aged 2 and 4. Now, he was working as a business banking manager for Bank of Scotland at that time, but he was due to begin a new position with an environmental business in Inverness 2 weeks after he was murdered. He'd been in the bank since he graduated, and I believe he'd become a bit jaded.
How many years was this he'd been with the bank then?
8 years.
Okay.
8 years, yeah, because this is in 2004.
And do we know if that was the same role that he did the whole time when he was in the bank? Or is he,
no,
he'd moved around.
He'd been promoted okay. a few times. And his last position in the bank before he left, he was managing a business banking team. But yeah, he'd been promoted sort of here and there. I believe from what I read that there wasn't really any more chance of promotion. I think he'd sort of come a bit stuck in his position. And
probably where he was as well. I mean, you would need to move down to probably central Scotland if you want to go to where all the head offices are of all the different
for
banks.
For sure. I think if you want a high-level position, if you're based up in the Highlands, I mean, it's just natural. Scotland's a small place. You know, there's only, what, population of 5 million in Scotland? You know, most of that being in the Central Belt. He's in the Highlands. There's just not as many opportunities in Scotland. And I think if there are, it's going to be in the Central Belt, I would think. Also, in Nairn, they had bought quite a big house, which was formerly a bed and breakfast and a restaurant.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so it sounds like they committed. They'd sort of put down roots there, read between the lines. That's what it seemed like to me. That's where they were going to be based. And where the house was, I think it's quite a central part of Nairn. There's a pub right opposite. Well, actually, a hotel, Havelock Hotel, is right opposite the house that they lived in. And, you know, it's just sort of like a beautiful, kind of typical, traditional type house that you would find in a place like this, Emma. You probably know what I'm talking about. The
big
sort of
stone.
Yeah, stone, yeah, the double front door. Just lovely.
Quite fancy for someone who's mm-hmm. working in the bank.
Another thing that I had read was that as of today, the house is worth about £400,000. Now, as you and I know, for Scotland, that's a significant amount of money. She was in graphic design. He was working in the bank. So, you know, probably a nice income coming in. But if you're not mortgaging that property, you know, I think that would be a bit of financial commitment. So that is important. That's important to bear in mind while I'm telling the story. So at the time that he was murdered, he was still at Bank of Scotland running a business banking team, but he'd become a bit jaded with it. It wasn't what he had originally sort of set out to do. It just wasn't meeting his needs anymore. It wasn't what he was looking to do. So this new position, I believe it was about a startup business, this environmental business in Inverness, and he was due to begin with them, I think, as a regional manager. For all intents and purposes, it sounds like he lived a fairly normal life. He was a bit of a homebody. He liked being with his family, you know, at home with his wife and kids. He wasn't like a party animal or anything. Seemed to be just quite a sort of polite, decent, reliable, dependable guy. Just sort of an all-round decent guy, basically. On Sunday, the 28th of November, 2004, at 7 p.m, Alistair was reading a bedtime story to his two young boys when the doorbell rang. His wife, Veronica, who was upstairs sorting out laundry, answered the door to a man in a baseball cap who asked for Alistair by name. And they were the only two words that he emitted, was just Alistair Wilson. That's all he said. Veronica left the stranger at the front door, leaving the front door open, and went inside to fetch her husband. According to a handful of witnesses who saw Alistair and the man talking at the door, presumably from the hotel across the road. The men spoke for a few minutes. Alistair then closed the front door and went back inside to speak to his wife. In his hand, Alistair had a blue or turquoise envelope and stated he didn't know who the man was that was at the door. The blue envelope was described as the kind that comes with a birthday card. Apparently, this blue turquoise envelope was empty and it had the name Paul written on it. Now, it seems as though Alistair was checking with his wife as to whether the man had actually asked for him. And Veronica assured him that he had asked for him by name. The indication given is that Alistair was confused by the conversation with the man, but the exact details of the conversation have not been revealed to the public. So those are the only details that have been released. So there might have been more context.
Yeah, I mean, if they've been speaking for a few minutes, there's definitely going to be more to it. We also don't know how much he had the chance to pass on to her regarding that conversation.
Exactly. Veronica stated that neither of them had any concern or fear. You know, neither of them thought that something sinister was going on.
I mean, to be fair, she left the door wide open. So if he was wanting to come in and murder them all or do whatever, then he could have done that.
Exactly. There was no cause for alarm, basically. It seems that after Alistair came back up to her and said, you know, I don't know who this guy is. Did he ask for me? She suggested putting the children to bed and then trying to figure out what was going on. However, Alistair decided to go back to the front door to see if the man was still there. So bear in mind that Alistair had shut the door and gone up to his wife. Now, I was always under the impression that he'd left the man waiting there for him to return.
Oh, okay.
But actually, this small part that she says that she suggested, right, okay, well, let me put the kids to bed and then let's sit down and actually talk about it. She's probably distracted. She's looking after two young children, you know, trying to get them organised for bed. I know if it was me, I'd probably say, right, let me just put them down and then we'll chat about it.
Nothing really happened yet. Anyway, exactly. All that really happened is someone turned up at the door, asked for him, given him an envelope. We don't know what they've discussed.
Yeah, it's just a weird thing
at this point.
So the fact that she says that he decided to return to the front door to see if the man was still there makes me think that he didn't leave him waiting there for his return. So Alistair did return to the front door. And when he did, it's not clear if it was immediately or if some more time elapsed. But after returning to the front door, he was shot 3 times. He was shot 2x in the head and 1x in the body. Now, the murderer left immediately, with the very few witnesses that saw him reporting that he wasn't rushing. He was actually walking. And I believe that Alistair's wife, Veronica, was one of those witnesses.
She must have heard it.
She described hearing what she thought were pallets fall into the ground, and she ran downstairs. Now, my understanding is that, as I said, this house had been a hotel or a B&B. There was a fire door at the top of the stairs, and I believe she was upstairs seeing to the boys. So there was probably, I imagine if it was a fire door, she probably wouldn't have had real clear hearing. She would have just heard a noise.
They're insulated. Yeah.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So anyway, she rushes downstairs and she finds her husband at the front door bleeding. Alistair's wife, Veronica, also confirmed that the blue envelope that Alistair had in his hand when he went back up to see her when she was putting the boys to bed was no longer there. So it disappeared. Despite efforts to save him, Alistair died around an hour later. 10 days following the murder, after some complaints of a blocked drain reached ahead, the drain in question was cleared, in which a gun was found. This gun is claimed to be the weapon which murdered Alistair Wilson. Now, the gun itself was a really bizarre factor of this case. The gun was a very small handgun. It was actually a German antique from circa 1920. And it was not the typical weapon of choice to carry out a murder. And one of the quotes that I got from one of the articles I was reading, which will be quoted in the show notes, is that the gun was, I'm probably going to butcher this pronunciation, but I'm going to give it a bash anyway, Hengel-Schmeitzer semi-automatic, known by nicknames like pocket pistol, ladies pistol, and handbag gun. because it was literally so tiny.
So that must have had a really small caliber bullet.
Apparently, the caliber is unusual as well, which it would be in such a small handgun. It's obviously a gun that would be very easy to conceal. There have only been 11 of these guns recovered in the UK, and around 40,000 of them were made in Germany prior to World War II. So the gun that was recovered is believed to have been produced between 1922 and 1930.
I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. Either it makes it less likely to be a professional hitman because they would surely have access to weapons and they probably would have mass-produced weapons, mass-produced bullets, or theoretically they could have stolen it from someone to commit the murder.
I mean, it could be anything, Emma. I mean, they could have bought it from a pawn shop. Could be anything. I think you would just pick a theory, basically.
I don't think it's bizarre.
It is very, very bizarre. So despite the gun being found less than a mile from the Wilson household, the street on which the gun was found, which was a street called Seabank Road, was not included in the search. So after something like this would happen, they would do a radius surrounding the crime scene, and they would literally be, you know, it's like a foot search. If they hadn't found it, that's one thing. But despite being less than a mile from the house, that road wasn't even searched. Now, bear in mind, this has been an execution-style murder on somebody's doorstep, and this murder weapon was less than a mile away. When they were asked why this was, the police did confirm it didn't fall within the search perimeter, which baffles me.
You'd think a mile would be the minimum perimeter.
You would think so. So, yeah, as I say, the gun didn't have any fingerprints on it. There was no forensic evidence found at the murder scene. And additionally, the killer was not captured on CCTV. Now, apparently, there was CCTV at the hotel across the road, which I think captured all or part of the Wilson household, but it wasn't working that night. I don't know if it just wasn't working at all, but whatever it was, it just wasn't working that night. So there was no CCTV found. They've pored over CCTV to find any trace of this guy, and they found none. As I say, although the Wilson's house was opposite a pub or a hotel, Havelock Hotel, only a small number of witnesses claimed to have seen the murderer. Now, a couple who were returning from a wedding boarded a bus from the bus station at Inverness, for a bus going to Nairn. Now, a man boarded the bus who gave the couple a strange vibe, and they believed he was up to something. The witness, named Tommy Hogg, said the man looked shifty, and whenever he looked at him, he looked away and pulled up his collar. The man got off the bus before Alistair Wilson's house, at the bus stop closest to their house, and walked in the direction of Crescent Road, which was the road that Alistair Wilson lived on. After hearing there had been a murder later that night, Tommy contacted the police as he had a good recollection of the man he had seen on the bus acting suspiciously. It sounds like it just stuck in their heads. Something was bizarre, it wasn't right. So he went to the police and gave a description. The police have never produced an effit of the man described by Tommy Hogg or by Veronica Wilson, who's Alistair's wife. A criminologist named Dr. Mohammed Rahman from Birmingham University, who wrote about the case, was contacted by Police Scotland, who told him that they showed Tommy Hogg an effit of the man they believed he saw, and Tommy Hogg confirmed it was accurate. The police then said that they traced and eliminated that man from their inquiries. However, this information was not shared with Tommy Hogg, and he was unaware of this development.
That's odd.
Certainty there, yeah. Now, an excerpt from the Daily Record, which is linked in the show notes, read, "Nearly 14,000 people have been spoken to, 3,500 statements taken, and there have been door-to-door inquiries at more than 1,000 addresses in the town, but no one has ever been arrested. Detectives have seized more than 700 items to examine for any evidence, and CCTV from 670 sources has been viewed, but nothing has led them to the killer or a motive. The discovery of the gun, which had been dumped just around the corner from Alistair's home in Crescent Road, has only perplexed detectives more." Now, the case was given a new lease of life in 2016 with a reinvigorated effort to solve it. Both the gun and a cigarette butt, which was apparently found on the doorstep of the Wilsons' house, is being subjected to more rigorous DNA testing called DNA 24. Now, the difference between this DNA testing and older DNA testing is that they used to only test 11 areas of DNA, whereas now it's 24 areas of DNA that will be interrogated. And I also believe the up-to-date DNA testing kit is more sensitive than older versions were. So, fingers crossed. Alistair's murder remains one of Scotland's most bizarre murder cases, which has never been solved. His wife and children still live in Nairn, in the same house, and are supported well by the local community. There have been numerous theories about why Alistair Wilson was murdered. The resounding theory seems to be that his assassination is related to his work in banking. There are theories, including that he was involved in organised crime, that he borrowed money from shady figures, there were links to Livingston Football Club's finances, and that he was potentially about to blow the whistle on lending practices at the bank. And one of the articles that I read confirmed that a man named Paul Moore was the head of risk management at the bank, and he was sacked weeks before Alistair's murder. I think it was about 2 weeks before. His sacking came shortly after he raised concerns about a loans strategy. Now, the article connects the loan strategy mentioned by Paul Moore to the subsequent $20.5 billion taxpayer bailout to prevent the bank's collapse after being acquired by Lloyds Bank in 2009. Now, Paul Moore confirmed he was the good practice manager at the time and said he would be the person people would approach if they had concerns about how the bank was operating, although he didn't actually know Alistair Wilson at the time that he was murdered. The Daily Mail article is dated May 2019 and confirms that Paul Moore was never questioned by police over Alistair's murder, and he believes he should have been. Connections have also been made between Paul Moore's name and the name on the envelope Alistair Wilson was holding the night he was murdered, because it had the single name Paul on the front of it, apparently. And he's aware of that theory, and he's also made that connection. Another theory put forward by a person known only by the name of Nate, who's an amateur armchair detective, believes the fact Alistair Wilson was due to leave his position with Bank of Scotland is pivotal. He was a young father living in a large house which he and his wife had recently failed to make a successful B&B and restaurant out of. There are articles which make mention of Alistair borrowing £50,000 from people linked to gangland criminals in Glasgow. The theory proposed by Nate is that the envelope provided was for Alistair to put documents or information in to assist those persons he was now linked to, or put money in to partly repay his loan, and he chose not to, which ultimately led to his assassination. The theory also proposes that the envelope would then be returned to the source who was requesting the information, a man named Paul. The murderer was described as being a white, stocky male, between 5'6" and 5'10" tall, and wearing a baseball cap and a dark bomber jacket. A former Met police detective named Peter Blexley is investigating the case and travelled to Nairn to find out more about the murder. He released a book in 2018 regarding the information he discovered and the theories about the case. The book is called To Catch a Killer, and there are also documentaries and a bunch of, you know, there's a bunch of stuff out there if people want to do a bit more reading and listening on this. There is another podcast, which is, I think it's like a 6-part series, by BBC Scotland investigative journalist Fiona Walker, and it's called The Doorstep Murder. I will take your questions, please.
Yeah, so it's kind of a, more of a comment. So we obviously both come from a financial services banking background. And yeah, that was the first thing that came to my mind, was to do with the whole financial crime side of it. Could scream money laundering to me.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it was business banking as well. It wasn't personal banking.
It's business banking. He could be sidestepping sanctions. He could be not doing correct checks on the companies. He could be, you know, falsifying information. There's so many ways that it's unfortunately very possible to do those kind of things. But yeah, that would be my first thought, is that he's got himself into some kind of trouble that he's not been able to get out of. And if he's been at that bank and then he's looking to move on to another role, and someone doesn't want those secrets getting out, how else are they going to deal with it? The whole thing is just totally bizarre. And the fact that he then took, you know, the envelope back with him, Was he hanging around? You know, why was he still there? Ugh, I just don't get it. I totally don't get it. It honestly feels like a Victorian whodunit.
It does, doesn't it?
What do you think? Do you have any feelings on this?
I mean, certainly when I read about this, the risk manager, Paul Moore, and, you know, him raising concerns and then it leading to a sacking, the fact the police have never spoken to him, links obviously being made to the subsequent bailout, because remember, this is before the financial collapse, and there were comments made that this was in the heyday of lending. Well, we know, because, you know, we worked through that time and we know what it was like, and we dealt with the clear up as well as a result. So we saw, especially, you know, what we've seen, what some lending practices were as well,
or lack thereof.
I found that very, very interesting about the risk manager.
It does make me feel that if it was related to him, he didn't know about it. The fact that he's put himself forward, unless he's really, really ballsy and really, really arrogant.
Well,
why would he say, yeah, no, that was me, I did that job. Why didn't the police speak to me? It seems like quite an unusual stance to take if you had something to do with it.
Definitely. And also, he says that he didn't know Alistair Wilson. However, I know, certainly now, and I think it was still the practice back then as well, for any whistleblowing or concerns about practice, it is anonymous.
Yeah.
So if he's completed a sort of, you know, a whistleblowing report, or, you know, contacted a hotline to discuss concerns, it would be anonymous. So as far as I'm aware, if he had actually gone through the correct channels and raised concerns, this risk manager might not actually be aware that he'd been in contact with them.
Say he's raised these concerns and they've gone to this man who's subsequently gotten fired, and then it's worked out by whomever that it only could have been Alistair Wilson that raised that, because that's the problem with some of these whistleblowing lines, and that's part of the issue why some people still don't want to report things, because unfortunately, only certain people have access to certain information. So it would be incredibly difficult not to work out who's reported on certain things.
Yeah, for sure.
So it could be quite clear that it was him. But then the other thing that got me, and maybe I'm going completely down a kind of conspiracy theorist rabbit hole. I'll go put my tinfoil hat on. Right back.
Go get the Baco foil out of the drawer, just go for it.
They're coming for me, aren't they? After you with your Annie Burgesson case and now this, we're both going to disappear one day. And if that happens, please, all of our lovely podcast friends, please do cover it. So the police, why didn't they do a more thorough job? Why didn't they speak to the risk manager? Why didn't they follow up on certain things? If there was an e-fit, why wasn't it released? How could that possibly harm the investigation? You know, they definitely found that guy and identified him, did they? Why didn't the guy that reported it find out about that? It's all very bizarre that such a high profile, brutal murder in such a small, like we said before, quite affluent, lovely seaside town, didn't get all the bells and whistles thrown at it. You would have thought that they would have immediately contacted all of the biggest police forces in the country, gotten all the experts. Just seems really bizarre that, you know, even a mile away, they weren't searching. And there's definitely something fishy about that CCTV not been on over the road.
Also, a couple of things I wanted to just mention. I thought I'd hold them back a little bit. Just for intrigue. So one bit that I held back on, because I wanted to hear your theories first and then let me know what you thought of this, is I was talking about a former undercover detective from the Metropolitan Police.
Yes.
Peter Blexley, who wrote the book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He has been up to Nairn a few times, digging about, trying to find something out. He has obviously been given some information over the years. And one of the pieces of information that he's been told is that the man who went to the front door of the house went to negotiate and not assassinate. But he was prepared to kill, clearly, because he had a gun. But he did not intend to kill. Something went wrong. Now, another piece that I thought you might find interesting. So this came from his book, apparently. Okay. This Peter Blexley, the former Met detective. So apparently, so this isn't the thing I was going to tell you, but this is another part. So do you have to talk about Livingston Football Club?
Yeah, which is hilarious because I grew up just outside of Livingston. I had nothing to do with it.
So apparently their finances were in a complete mess at the time, which apparently it was known. It was common knowledge among some members of the legal profession, apparently, in the Central Belt. They were losing money hand over fist. And in February 2004, hours after a League Cup semi-final win over Dundee, the club was forced into administration by the Bank of Scotland with debts of £7.2 million.
Whoa.
Apparently, players and staff were made redundant as the administrator took over the running of the club. Now, no one involved with Livingston in 2004 is still there, so the club is unable to address the allegations and Police Scotland hasn't commented on them. This is the thing that I was holding back from you, right? So, in 2009, so 5 years after the murder, this Peter Blexley, former undercover Metropolitan Police detective, was in Nairn digging around trying to find out what was going on, find a bit of information. He found himself in a bar after several days of interviewing. And when he went to the toilet, a Scottish voice from behind him said, "Don't turn around. This is all I'm going to tell you. It was an in-house job, but we just couldn't prove it." Now, apparently there were police in the bar that night, and Peter's assumption is that it was a police officer that spoke to him. The frustration is that it's not clear when they say in-house, did they mean
in the bank or in the bank? In the police?
His family? In the police. So
it seems highly unlikely to be his family. It doesn't sound like the wife would have really had anything to gain. There's no reports of any. Plus there was people across the road that literally saw the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I don't really put any stock in that. I absolutely wouldn't be shocked if there was police and members of the bank involved.
They've ruled his wife out. They've said that they have no suspicion about her, that she's essentially been cleared.
That's like something out of a film though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You imagine being that guy going there to write your novel and find out what happened, and you're in a toilet and someone says, I mean, that's mm-hmm. quite chilling.
Yeah, it is.
I do have a bit of a warped sense of humour, and there is like a slight childishness in me that if I knew that he was there doing that, I'm not going to lie, I would be sorely tempted to just like throw a complete herring in there and like, did you ask about the blind horse?
Yeah.
Three crows miles away. Don't blink twice, you'll miss it. You know, that kind of thing. And then just see what happens. Yeah. But yeah, no, that one's a bit more plausible, to be fair.
I am sure that he'll have information that he's probably playing close to his chest, because he's been looking into it, I think, for 12 years.
But he's not going to get credit for it now if he's not solving it. So was he like, well, I've not solved it, but hey, I wrote a book.
A few theories, I think. But yeah, I mean, for me, in terms
of... I'm going to say money laundering with a police person.
Connected, potentially.
Yeah.
To me, it's money. It's money related, whether it's with the bank or, you know, if he did borrow money from shadowy gangsters, whatever. The fact that he had, you know, a wife, two young boys, they were living in a substantial house. He was on a Scottish salary, which we know isn't the same as a London-based kind of salary. They were trying to make it go with this B&B/restaurant business. To me, there is question about finances. On the one hand, though, it doesn't make sense to me why he would need to go through unorthodox methods of borrowing. If he worked for a bank and he was in lending and he knew what the criteria was and he was on, you know, a comfortable salary with his wife, potentially also on a comfortable salary if she was still working, I can't see why he would need to go down the route of being involved with criminals in order to borrow £50,000, which is not a huge amount of money.
You could be borrowing from Peter, literally, to pay Paul in this instance. No pun intended. But yeah, it could be one of those things where he's got himself wrapped up in something and didn't really know how to get out of it, was trying to get cash to pay people off. You know, Maybe. Remember, he's only 30 at this time.
Yeah, it was only 30. So still, I mean, still really young. Yeah, I would say money laundering is probably the best bet, whether he was involved in it, whether he was aware of it, maybe found out about it. But, you know, that's this Nate person that put the theory forward about the fact that he was leaving this job in the bank being problematic and also pivotal in the case. I agree. Timing, I agree with that.
Absolutely, yeah.
He was a qualified accountant as well. So clearly good with numbers, and he had a degree in business law. Apparently he always knew that he wanted to work with a bank, even when he was at school or university. So he had a clear idea of what he wanted to do, you know, and he went straight in there in the graduate program the same year that he graduated from university. And, you know, he'd been there for 8 years, and he was coming out of banking completely. He was going to this environmental company, which I believe was a new startup company in Inverness. As I say, we know what lending practices were like in 2004. Just throw money at people, basically. The fact that he was feeling sort of a bit jaded and, you know, wasn't what he was looking to do, and he was looking for this change and, you know, moving into a different industry.
Maybe he felt unsafe, and that was part of the wanting to move.
Potentially. I mean, I think, you know, Scotland is a small place, and if you're in quite a significant role within a bank, that's just not like a small job that hundreds of other people hold, that you're sort of just, you know, one of many. That's quite a prominent position, if you will. And there aren't that many banks in Scotland. Mm-hmm. You know, they're either owned or partly owned or merged with other companies and things. We know Bank of Scotland, or Halifax Bank of Scotland, as they were eventually known, and they're now Lloyds, were huge. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be really hard if you were in a prominent position at the bank and you had concerns about stuff that was going on. I think it would be difficult, or you'd be reluctant, to move into the same position in just another big corporation, because ultimately, to me, I would think that it would be endemic. Do you know what I mean? I would just think, well, if it's happening here, it's happening at every other bloody bank.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So to me, that would make sense that he would then go, do you know what? Stuff this, cash my last check. I'm gonna leave the bank and just change direction. That, to me, that would make sense.
Yeah, totally, absolutely. Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, I've always been like a bit of a goody two shoes with stuff like that, but I don't know. Do you ever get that feeling where you just feel like something shady's going on and it just makes you feel really uncomfortable?
Yeah,
not necessarily just in work, but just in life in general.
I think if you've got somebody who can be influenced into that kind of thing, I think once they've got their claws into you, that's it. So I've always felt that way. So there you go. That is the case of Alistair Wilson. Do you have a light-hearted true crime-related fact for us?
I do, and I picked this one. It's just a little fun story about a crime, and I picked it because it reminds me of something you might get involved with.
Right.
Okay. Two Welsh tourists landed themselves in court in 2012 after they got drunk and stole a penguin called Dirk from SeaWorld in Australia. Reese Owen Jones, who was 21, and Kerry Mules, who was 20. By the way, is that not such like a 21-year-old kind of thing to do? Like,
oh, I thought you were going to say, is that first name not the most Welsh name you've heard?
Reese Owen Jones. It's kind of like a name you would make up. Like,
yeah.
So they were from South Wales. They broke into the park on Queensland's Gold Coast. Then they swam with the dolphins. At least they're checking stuff off their bucket list as they go. They let off a fire extinguisher in the shark enclosure.
No.
Which I'm very sad about. And I don't really understand what the aim of that was.
No, I don't like that.
No, I don't like that part at all. But that's good, because they did end up in trouble with the police. So, you know, good. We'll do with that part.
Hopefully got in trouble for that bit.
They stole Dirk. So they stole this. They stole the penguin.
Penguin.
Oh. Which, to be fair, is probably the only portable thing they could have stolen. I mean, they're not
portable. What, because they can't fly?
So they woke up completely hungover and they had this penguin in their apartment.
No.
And they tried, and the quote is, their incompetent best to care for him by feeding him and putting him in the shower. They later released him into a canal.
No.
And were spotted by locals who called the police.
No.
A magistrate fined them $1,000 Australian each and told them to drink a little less vodka. Dirk was unharmed,
good,
thankfully, and he was rescued and he was returned to SeaWorld.
Let's hope he didn't have PTSD.
I think
penguin traumatic syndrome disorder, whatever it's called.
Oh my god. So I'll send you the link to this article. Put it in the show notes and see if
I will.
Is Dirk a common penguin name? I don't feel like it is. Oh, he was bred in captivity and part of a breeding colony. I mean, he's a fairy penguin. Oh my god, you couldn't make that up.
Fairy?
Fairy penguin.
Never heard of that.
Either. Dirk had never been out of captivity before. Like, was Dirk like, this is it, this is my moment, I'm free, I've escaped, and then he got returned. But apparently Dirk had a partner called Peaches. Dirk has been reunited with Peaches.
I've never heard of a fairy penguin before. So it's a blue penguin, also called little penguin, little blue penguin, or fairy penguin, characterised by its diminutive stature and pale blue to dark grey plumage.
Like I said, portable.
Oh, it is the smallest of all known penguin species. Oh, they're lovely.
I know.
I wonder what they fed him. I would like to think it was fish.
No, you know fine well.
Tried to feed him like Doritos or something,
it would absolutely be Doritos. Oh no, it's in Australia, so it'd be Tim Tams.
All right.
Because that's all that I know that Australian people eat.
Hungry Jacks.
Hungry Jacks, yeah. And barbecue. Prawns from the barbecue.
Maybe we should stop stereotyping Australian people now.
Yeah. If we did ever have any Australian listeners, that's them gone now. Oh, yeah. Sorry, guys.
We do have Australian listeners. Oh, we actually have listeners from New Zealand as well.
Oh, that's exciting.
We do. Actually, speaking of which, I'm going to quickly give a little shout out to our smaller demographics because I think that would exciting. Be... Yeah, I think that'd be quite nice because...
We have no idea how you found us. So please can you let us know because that would be very, very interesting.
Yes.
So, yeah, you'll get our contact details at the end, but please do get in contact with us and let us know how you find us. And also, if you go to any other podcasts that we've recommended, can you please let them know that we sent you, because that would be really lovely.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously the majority of our listener base is in the UK. Thank you very much, all you British people. And you know, the usual is what we would expect, the USA, Canada, Netherlands, Australia. However, we have, you know, good few in India, Guernsey, Ireland, New Zealand. Now, the numbers where we have less than 10 listeners this month is Czech Republic, France, Romania, the UAE, so United Arab Emirates, Denmark, Greece, Iceland, Switzerland, Germany, Spain, Sweden, and Turkey.
Oh, wow. Gosh, that's so exciting.
Yeah, so that is just for this month, though.
It's like the Eurovision Song Contest when you're like reading out all the names there. Got really excited. So I guess that's based on their IP address or something then.
Yeah, it must be, because there are some that are unknown. So out of all our listeners that we've ever had, these are the countries where we've had 8 listeners in France and Italy, 6 in Norway and Sweden, 4 in Austria and Finland, 3 in the Netherlands, South Africa, Spain, Nigeria and Mexico, 2 in Argentina, Germany, Algeria and Poland, and 1 in Brazil, Indonesia, Iceland, Malta, Malaysia, Slovakia and Thailand. So shout out to our one listener in each of those countries.
Thank you, international listeners.
Thank you very much, because that is a really wide demographic, which I would never have expected us to get. We expected the likes of the UK, Canada, you know, the former colonies, New Zealand, India, things like that, but not in some of the other countries. So thank you so much for listening to us.
I'm very intrigued by the unknowns, because I'm wondering if it's like, do you remember the secret charter flights that you were talking about for that emergency case? Yeah. I'm wondering if they're kind of like flying under the radar, trying to see if you've dug any deeper, see if they're coming to get you.
Yeah. It'll be people that have got a VPN on.
Yeah, no, I am aware of that. I just quite enjoy the conspiracy theory. Thank you so much for listening to us. If you've got a case that you would like us to consider covering, you can email us. Our email address is info@murdershespoke.net. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have enjoyed listening, please do consider leaving us a 5-star rating and review on your favourite podcast platform. We'll be back next week.